There's a lake in a desert, 4,200 feet above sea level. It's fed by several rivers, which will never make it to the sea. They only make it here. Under the hot desert sun, fresh water evaporates, leaving behind the salts and minerals carried on the backs of the rivers through hundreds of miles of rocky mountains, high-elevation juniper forests, and some grasslands. On average, the lake is only 20 feet deep, but it's four times saltier than the ocean. The lake is home to hundreds of species of birds who feed on the thriving brine shrimp population that finds the salinity of these waters just right. The lake is cut in half by a causeway, a bridge whose foundation restricts the mixing of water from one half to the other. A city near the shore of the lake shares its name and is home to 2 million thirsty people. They have to use the water before it reaches the lake, though, when it's still fresh, to water their crops, to use in their homes. As the city grows, less and less of the water feeds the lake, and it's drying up.
Now the lake's maybe 10% of its natural size, and now there's a lot of concern about, well, the organisms that use the lake. They used to have flamingos, for example, that would feed on brine shrimp. Those have disappeared because the lake is way too salty for brine shrimp even.
If you were surprised at the mention of flamingos, don't feel stupid.
Yeah, my name is Wayne Wurzbach. I work in the Watershed Sciences Department at Utah State, where I'm a professor.
Wayne Wurzbach studies the Great Salt Lake in Utah, the one you were probably imagining. But he also studies its uncanny twin, Lake Urmia in Iran, which he visited last year.
They invited us over there because they said, oh, these people at the Great Salt Lake, very similar to ours, and they manage it really well. Whereas us that work on the lake, we sort of see all the problems that we do have. But we are managing it. We sort of have a head start on what the people in Iran have to deal with. In preparation for giving my paper there, I sort of tried to compare the Great Salt Lake and Lake Urmia, and why was Lake Urmia in such terrible shape where maybe the Great Salt Lake wasn't, it's not drying up completely yet.
One big difference is that Lake Urmia is located closer to the equator than Utah. So the Iranians have a longer growing season, which means they're diverting fresh water for agriculture for more months of every year. And even though the city of Urmia on its shores is very similar in population to Salt Lake City, the watershed basin is home to over 6 million people, which is twice the population of the state of Utah. As a result, Lake Urmia has gotten as small as 10% of its historic average size, with the combination of drought and diversion. The Great Salt Lake hasn't quite gotten to such an alarming low.
However, when we looked at things, and I looked at some results by a guy named Craig Miller, who's with the Utah Division of Water Resources, and his analysis shows that if we hadn't diverted water over the last 150, 160 years, that the Great Salt Lake would be 11 feet higher than it is now. And when you do some conversions and know the shape of the lake basin and so forth, that converts to the fact that we have about 50% less water in the Great Salt Lake now than we would if we hadn't been diverting water for these uses we put it to. And so the worry is we're headed the same way as Lake Urmia. We're not getting there quite as fast.
70% of the freshwater inflow to the Great Salt Lake comes from the Bear River, and the state is putting millions of dollars aside right now for a massive development project which will divert a lot more of the river before it reaches the lake. But unlike Iran, we're not using our freshwater supplies to support a bunch of crops for our food. We're mostly using the Bear River to grow alfalfa for cows. And if that was the only thing we were using it for, we'd probably be all right. Why then, as our population grows, are we using more and more water?
So Utah is, of all the states in the United States, is the second highest water use per capita per person. So we use more than almost any other people in the United States. We use a lot of water here. It's hot, so that explains part of it. In a lot of parts of the country, when it gets hot in the summer, the lawns just go brown. People are used to that. Our culture here has kind of evolved, so we want big green lawns around our houses, and that takes a lot of water.
Now, if you value green lawns and you don't care much for the Great Salt Lake, what would your incentive be to conserve water, to let that fresh, clean water reach the Salt Lake and turn into brine shrimp habitat?
Several million birds a year come through, so this would be ducks and geese and shorebirds. And so we utilize those for recreation, either bird watching or for hunting, or maybe we feel just a responsibility to maintaining that resource and maintaining that population. So that's one value. Another value would be our air quality. And so if we dry up the Great Salt Lake, as we're tending to do now, we're going to have more and more dust storms increasing. A big concern back at Lake Urmia is how the salt coming off those salt beds of the dried lake will affect agriculture. From Farmington Bay, where we have really high nutrients that come in there and make a lot of algae grow, there's a type of algae called cyanobacteria, and they produce toxins. And those dry out and get out on the dry lake bed. And there hasn't been much research on this, but there's some studies actually from Iraq and a few other places that those toxins from those dried out algae cause human health problems. There's another large lake in Southern California that was dried up long ago to divert water to the LA Basin. And the dust storms off that lake cause pretty severe asthma problems and other health problems in the small communities that are near that lake.
He's talking about Owens Lake in California, dried up for almost 100 years, which is the single largest source of PM10 air pollution in the country. But the downwind population of that toxic dust is relatively small. If there were equivalent dust storms off the Great Salt Lake, a couple million people would be affected. In California, they're pumping water back into the dry lake bed every day to mitigate the dust, which is kind of ironic. If we could just keep water in these desert lakes in the first place, we wouldn't need to figure out how to fill them back up. Every inland saltwater lake in the world is similarly threatened. The Great Salt Lake isn't in as bad a shape as lakes like Urmia and the Aral Sea in Central Asia, which went from being one of the four largest lakes in the world to not even being a lake anymore at all after a Soviet plan in the 1960s diverted all of the lake's source rivers for agriculture. But Wayne Wurzbach and a lot of other researchers believe strongly that the lake is worth saving for the birds, for the prevention of dust storms, for the recreation opportunities, for the $1.3 billion the state makes from mining salt and minerals and from the world's largest brine shrimp industry. This year, the Great Salt Lake is approaching its lowest level in recorded history. In 1963, the elevation of the lake was 4,191 feet. It's hovering a foot or two above that, but it's on target this year to match or get lower than that. Anyone who's lived in Utah for a few years knows that the lake level fluctuates. It goes up in the spring when the snow melts and our northern Utah rivers bring that water down from the mountains. It evaporates all summer when we see very little rain and long hot days. The bigger snowpack years bring bigger runoff and more water ends up in the lake.
So my wife and I arrived in the valley in 1983 and we had the two back-to-back 100-year runoff events and the lake was flowing across Interstate 80 and just going over the tops of dikes. And so for my introduction, that was the normal characteristics. And skiing was great in the mountains. And as I said earlier, even with those bumps, ups and downs in there, the overall trend is definitely headed downward.
We've been here before, but things are wildly different than they were in the 1960s when people like Wayne Wurzbach were studying other bodies of water, fresher bodies of water with active fisheries, longer food chains, and more complex ecosystems. Appreciation of the Great Salt Lake is a fairly new phenomenon. Prior to the 1980s, Wurzbach says, the whole ecosystem was seen as a dump, a place to dump waste where it would sink down and be out of sight. And every drop of fresh water that made it to the lake was also seen as a waste. This view is changing radically thanks to ecology researchers and state agencies putting money and effort into understanding the lake and its purpose. Desiccation, or the drying up of the lake, is only one of the major threats to the ecosystem. There's also concern about the amount of metals in the lake, invasive wetland species like Phragmites, and the toxic algae blooms in parts of the lake where sewage acts like a fertilizer. What can we do to help save the Great Salt Lake? Be good water citizens, for one, but also we can go there, visit the lake, get to know it a little bit.
When I have students in my class, I often ask how many people have been out on the Great Salt Lake, and I don't get many hands go up. And then I ask how many have been to Antelope Island, which is very easily accessed and a really nice state park, and I get a few hands that go up. One of the issues I think that keeps people from going there. There was an article in the National Geographic that was written when we were having the Winter Olympics here. And I think I've got the quote right from there, is the citizens of the Salt Lake Valley view the Great Salt Lake as a putrid, fly-infested sump. And so that's not a great moniker to have associated with your lake. Part of that, I think, is due, I mentioned all those nutrients and the heavy algal growth in Farmington Bay. I think a lot of the lake stink, as we refer to it, comes out of the heavy algal growth and the decomposition, the putrefaction of there. So I think we wrote a paper long ago saying the Great Salt Lake doesn't stink, but Farmington Bay does.
The Great Salt Lake can either be seen as a vital resource or an embarrassment. We can either complain about the stink that comes off of it when we flush our toilets into it, or we can appreciate the way it defines our state. In a lot of ways, its waters protect us from ourselves, from all the waste that's entombed at the bottom in the muck that we don't really want to ever see again. Birds come from all over the world to visit, and other places that are in dire need of ecological advice are looking to Utah, asking us how we do it. Well, they're asking people like Wayne Wurtzbach how we do it. You're listening to The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. We're talking about the Great Salt Lake and how it's underappreciated here in Utah. Well, Elaine Taylor recently visited another salt lake in the West, the Salton Sea in California. Here's her story.
Like most February days in Southern California, it's sunny and near 80 degrees. My boyfriend and I, both being very fair, have smeared a thick layer of SPF 50 onto our exposed skin. We have decided to forego a fancy dinner for Valentine's Day and instead camp in the remote desert near Joshua Tree National Park. Every other couple from LA has apparently decided to do this too, and the park feels an awful lot like Disneyland. Escaping the throngs of people, we take off on a barren backcountry road toward the Imperial Valley's Salton Sea. Naturally, this Rift Valley lake has come in and out of existence for thousands of years. The most recent regeneration, however, was a man-made accident. In the early 1900s, engineers built canals to connect the Colorado River to the valley. The river swelled, and unstoppable water flowed into the valley for 2 years. What was left became the Salton Sea, California's largest lake. At the beginning, the Salton Sea brought a lot of money into the area. Movie stars visited and went water skiing. The lake never had a natural tributary or outlet, and now it just keeps getting drier and saltier. Sometimes water flows in, but a lot of it is agricultural runoff and full of chemicals. The sea is lined with what looks like white sand beaches, but upon closer inspection, I realize it isn't sand, but pulverized fish bones and barnacles. There are dead fish everywhere. 15 miles down the beach from the state recreation area's picnic tables and visitor center is Bombay Beach, a town of 300 that takes up less than a square mile. Past a rundown bar that claims to be North America's lowest place to get a drink is a small convenience store. I buy a can of Coke while Clint gets an ice cream bar from the freezer. As we sit in the car, doors open, people watching, it seems that ogling tourists like us are the only thing keeping the place in business. We've stopped at Bombay Beach because of the promise of destruction. Bombay used to be, by all accounts, a hip place in the 50s and 60s, with nightclubs and attractive people. Then the clubs closed and the sea got saltier. In the late 70s, the Salton Sea swelled with water from a passing hurricane. At the time, there wasn't a berm on the water's edge, and America's lowest town flooded. The interesting thing, the thing that draws me to Bombay Beach, is that the people living on the water's edge just left. Occupied homes with cars and yippie dogs in the yard sit next to places that have been gutted by water. It's the normality of the place that is haunting. Cans of creamed corn still sit in the cupboard of a house with half a fence and a permanently open front door. There's a suitcase strewn across the floor, like someone started packing but instead gave up and left everything. One home has a newspaper from the 1980s sitting on the ground, untouched. We wander through the homes, like other visitors, being careful to leave this perfect bit of destruction just as we found it, a museum dedicated to a shrinking sea and town. Looking over the water from Bombay Beach, the lake looks peaceful and serene. There's a constant mist that settles over the water, obscuring the mountains in the distance. There used to be a handful of different types of fish in the lake, but now the only species that can survive in the saline waters is tilapia. Hundreds of thousands of them teeming in a sea less than half the size of the Great Salt Lake. It seems strange to me that humans have carried sea creatures into a valley that just over 100 years ago could barely support terrestrial life, let alone marine life. At some point, not even the tilapia will survive, and I wonder how many more of the seaside dwellers will stick around, too. Over the years, there have been efforts to save the Salton Sea, but the future of the lake is still unclear. If the sea is allowed to dry up, I often wonder what future archaeologists will think, finding this tilapia graveyard in the middle of the desert, ringed by long-gone settlements. Would they think we had reached too far, trying to bring life into a mostly inhospitable place? Would they know that for every person eking out a living along the shore, there were thousands more willing to drive hours to come and look upon our fellow man's destruction and bad luck? I was so excited to visit the Salton Sea, but at the end of the long, hot day, I was just as excited to drive back to Los Angeles and be packed in with my fellow city dwellers like the tilapia in the ever-shrinking waters.
Elaine Taylor, reporting from the Salton Sea in California. When we return after a quick break, we'll get to hear from you. I have stories from listener trips to see the spiral jetty on the saltiest part of the lake. Stay with us. This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. In Seattle, on those rare days when the clouds part, when the ceiling lifts, people say the mountain's out instead of the sun's out, meaning that Mount Rainier is visible, looming over the cityscape. Lately, with the water level of the Great Salt Lake being as low as it is, people in Utah have been saying the jetty's out, meaning the spiral jetty is above water. In 1970, when the spiral jetty was created, the water level, or the elevation of the lake surface, was right around 4,195 feet. In 1972, the water came up and stayed up. During the wet years of the early to mid-80s, the spiral jetty was underwater, visible only when there were just a few inches of water over the top and completely gone when the water was deeper. Since around 2002, the spiral jetty has appeared and disappeared, depending on the water level, and now, in our current drought, it's been high and dry for pretty much the whole year. The spiral jetty, if you're not familiar, is a work of art, a giant sculpture created out of the landscape and the elements found nearby. It's a 1,500-foot-long coil made out of rocks that juts into the northern arm of the Great Salt Lake near Roselle Point. The artist, Robert Smithson, thought about creating what would become the spiral jetty in Bolivia. He was drawn to the pink, salty waters of the desert lakes of South America. But for logistics, feasibility, and real estate reasons, the spiral jetty ended up in the Great Salt Lake. But Utah had what Smithson wanted: the fantastic natural color of the water, the contrast of black volcanic basalt, and of course the white crystals of the salt. One of the unintended consequences of the spiral jetty's placement in the Great Salt Lake is that it provides a great excuse for people to go out and visit the lake. It's something that draws you to a completely foreign landscape that's right there in the proverbial backyard for people who live along the Wasatch Front. I asked you, listeners of The Source, to tell me about your experiences at the spiral jetty and the Great Salt Lake.
One of the things that's amazing about the spiral jetty is that you never know what you're going to experience until you get there. It might be barely visible, and then if you have a drier year, like we do now, you can, you know, completely walk out on it. My husband and I had our engagement photographs taken out on the spiral jetty in front of it. Yeah, and our photographer, ironically, had never been out to the spiral jetty. Even though we told him how long it would take to get there, I think he was still surprised.
I walked on it, and I didn't have good shoes, and so I kind of cut my toes because those rock crystals are the salt crystals on the rocks are really sharp. So wear your good shoes. But it was, I did the walk. I had to do the whole thing because you can't not do the entire loop if you're going to go out there. I mean, it's a commitment to go out and drive out there.
It's kind of desolate, but there's a lot of beauty to it because there's just nothing there but the lake. And you know, mountains in the distance, and when I was there before, there was a lot more salt showing on the jetty, and it's like almost like ice or snow when you look out on it, and it just seems like it's almost like a mirage when you look in the distance. You know, it's just white and icy and flat.
The first time, it was exceedingly cold. It was in February, and the water was pretty high, so you could only walk a portion of the way out, but it was quite beautiful because it was over the lake was a huge flock of white falcons, and I had never seen that many, and so they They literally snaked their way over the river and then came over us over the spiral jetty. And so it was actually quite a, dare I say, spiritual moment. I went out there with somebody who had never been there before, and they were visiting. And when we got out there, it was even better than what their expectations were. The water was even lower. So at that time, that was this past summer, we were able to walk the entire spiral to the center and then back again. And you started to get a sense of what Smithson was going for.
One of the things that surprised me about it is that right where the jetty is, the hills, the basalt goes up right behind it. So much of the Great Salt Lake is really flat, flat, flat. And so it's hard to actually get a perspective on the lake itself. But with a very short walk, you can climb up and really see not only the jetty, but the mountains and the islands off in the lake.
Those are some voices from the Spiral Jetty Story Booth I set up at Utah State University's Science Unwrapped lecture series on the Great Salt Lake. That last voice you heard might have sounded familiar. It belongs to Wayne Wurzbach, who I had a hand in persuading to go to the Spiral Jetty for the first time after our interview. We also heard from Katie Lee Coven, Catherine Bazant, Linda Lai, and Mark Lee Coven. I like this story, submitted online from Sean Bliss in Logan. He says, I was just there last November with my friend Dave, his infant daughter, and my 9-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter. We crammed into his pickup and took the long drive from Logan. It was one of the first really cold days of the season, overcast and windy and moody, with snow flurries blowing across the lake and obscuring the tops of the mountains along the way. The moment I first saw the site was a little underwhelming, given the scale of the surrounding area, but this impression changed later as we walked the spiral. As we got out of the truck, bundled up the kids, and began to walk to the jetty, I was surprised at just how primal and atmospheric the environment was. I don't know if I would have had the same emotional reaction if I'd experienced the jetty on a sunny summer day, but on our visit, it was almost overwhelming, primordial and cosmic, more like a natural phenomenon than something man-made. The landscape, though perfectly ordinary to a person raised in the Western U.S., had an alien, almost mythological edge, which was aesthetically satisfying and a little dangerous feeling. After hearing so many great Spiral Jetty stories, I felt compelled to go back out to the site myself. I had a friend from Alabama in town, and I dragged him out there on a gorgeous first day of spring. The water was a kind of whitish blue, and so was the sky. And we got this impulsive idea to lie down on the ground on the salt. And as we were looking up at the sky, a flock of pelicans flew right over us, really low. It was so quiet you could hear the air through their feathers with their wing beats. It was super cool. My whole Spiral Jetty story is up at upr.org if you're interested. The reason why the Spiral Jetty is in the north arm of the lake is precisely because it's so salty. The color that drew Robert Smithson to Roselle Point is caused by microorganisms called extremophiles, because they thrive in extreme environments like some of the saltiest water on the planet. We've already learned why the lake is salty. It's a natural process. But another man-made structure on the lake is messing with the balance of the lake's saline waters. The source's Ross Chambliss takes us to the railroad causeway that splits the Great Salt Lake in half.
Zipping past an oncoming train on this narrow causeway crossing the Great Salt Lake, Bill Johnson, a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah, steers his Subaru with 4 graduate students packed along for the ride. A green canoe is strapped to the roof. They're headed out to the middle of the lake to test the waters.
Uh-huh. You're going in the boat.
Okay.
But we just need to bring the stuff down there now.
Built in 1959, this rock runway isolated the lake's north arm, known as Gunnison Bay, which, as it turned out, was saturated with salt, 9 times saltier than the ocean, in fact. The water takes on a purplish hue. The main part of the lake, by comparison, is blue. It's also salty, but inflowing freshwater from the Jordan, Weber, and Bear Rivers keep it more hospitable for migrating birds, brine shrimp, and industries that harvest salt and other minerals from the water. A few years ago, Union Pacific closed two crumbling culverts connecting the two sides of the causeway for safety. The causeway that carries 10 to 15 trains a day has actually been sinking deeper into the lake. Despite the barrier, though, Johnson says water still seeps into the south arm through the causeway, creating a deep brine layer.
We don't know this for a fact, but it's implicated that the deep brine layer is the source of methylmercury that results in elevated mercury that we observe in duck species in the south arm of the lake. Westminster College has done a nice job measuring spiders on the shore of the lake and showing that they're loaded with methylmercury. And the potential vector from the deep brine layer to the spiders at the shores of the lake is through like brine fly on the shores of the lake. And potentially brine shrimp. We don't know the pathway yet, and we're trying to understand that better.
The high concentration of methylmercury in the lake has worried many for years. Scientists have determined the mercury enters the lake from the atmosphere, and they've sourced much of it to gold mining operations in Nevada. Burning coal is also a source. At any rate, methylmercury is a neurotoxin. It's particularly dangerous for babies, but also adults if fish, birds, or other contaminated foods are consumed in high doses.
Nobody's drinking deep brine layer water, but the potential for propagation to the ecosystem is there. And in fact, there's a big experiment in place right now, because with the closure of the causeway, the deep brine layer is actually disappearing because we don't have the flow from the north to the south anymore. And so what we need to be doing is monitoring the mercury levels in the ecosystem, in the birds and the spiders and other organisms that we can monitor surrounding the lake to understand, to see if we see a response.
Still, Johnson says we don't know enough yet about how methylmercury develops in the deep brine layer to say that keeping the causeway closed would keep mercury out of the environment. He says it should be studied more. Laura Ault with Utah's Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands says it's only a matter of time until the causeway is reopened.
The circulation of brine is huge to both the North Arm and the South Arm operators. And when I say that, I'm talking about not only the mineral industries, but the brine shrimp industry and other folks that operate on the lake. And you have to strike a fine balance between having the right amount of circulation, you know, just enough or not too much.
The state is taking the railroad company to task to bring back the exchange of flows that existed when the culverts were open. A disagreement over an easement to cross the state's sovereign lands is holding up the project for now. But when completed, managers imagine the bridge becoming a powerful tool to maintain ideal salinity levels. Linda Freitas with Friends of Great Salt Lake says that's something most stakeholders on the lake want to see.
The South Arm extractive industries are very concerned about, you know, how is this opening and the dynamic of flow going to affect those operations? Because what they don't want is they don't want the flow to travel from south to north. They want salt to come from the north into the south so they can have the brine levels that they need in order to extract what they're looking for and maintain their existing operations. The brine shrimp, the range of 12 to 17% salinity. You know, we know that there have been brine shrimp cysts or eggs in the North Arm, but that was pretty much during the high lake level years in the 80s. And even then, you know, the water was high in the North Arm. So there is this sensitivity to the ecological needs and how circulation occurs.
Not far from where Bill Johnson and his students test the deep brine layer, long stretches of the lake bed along the causeway lie exposed under the baking sun, drying out. Johnson says he and others who study toxins in the lake worry what could happen if deeper areas of the lake bed are revealed due to continued drought, climate change, or from damming the Bear River.
The exposure of the lake bed is a potential concern. It's a concern and it's a potential hazard because we have the metropolitan area right near that exposed lake bed, and disturbance of that lake bed would result in the potential increase in dust throughout the metropolitan area. And that dust itself can carry potentially a health hazard because there's a lot of mineral deposit into these lake beds through the formation of different complexes. And in the deeper part of the lake, those complexes are things like sulfide deposits that contain lead, uranium, mercury, arsenic. And this is a terminal lake. It's naturally concentrated. So you have very high trace element concentrations in the sediments in this lake. And so, you know, increasing the potential for those to become airborne is a genuine concern that needs to be considered.
When it comes to the causeway, this land bridge splitting the lake in two, low lake levels also play havoc with the lake's salt balance. Linda Freitas says envisioning a future of much lower lake levels should be part of the planning for the future bridge and breach of the causeway.
And a part of evaluating that is going to have to come through kind of trial and error. The construct of this opening and a way of somehow regulating this exchange, this flow, will have to come through a series of, there'll be some berms that'll be incorporated in this structure, earthen berms that can be changed. And based on monitoring and evaluation of those results, the berm can be moved aside or it can be built up. So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a process that we're going to have to wait and see.
It's taken years for all the interests, demands, and realities of the people using the lake to reach a point of harmony. But it's a delicate balance that just one party could easily disturb, De Freitas says. That's the tension mounting with the broken railroad causeway. The railroad company says they must prove their new bridge and berm operate effectively for 5 years before they turn control over to the state. Whether the new bridge will improve the lake is unclear.
If one use is possibly going to be, you know, the kiss of the Spider Woman for this resource, then why wouldn't you hold them to a standard of fiscal commitment and being there to respond accordingly in order to make this the best scenario possible for all of the other uses? You know, time will tell. One of the things that, you know, again, the emphasis of, because the lake has gone through high and low trends, we can't just monitor this causeway and these changes for 5 years or 7 years. We really have to be there, you know, for a long trend of understanding if this new opening with these variations that we're going to have to fiddle around with is actually working the way we hope. This is the first opportunity in a long time that we've had to perhaps change a paradigm for the lake with an existing structure that has, you know, created a footprint.
Ross Chambliss for The Source. Super jealous that he got to go out on that causeway. We'll have more from Ross when we return. You're listening to The Source on Utah Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. It's hard to talk about the Great Salt Lake without talking about the Bear River. They're like the head and the tail of the same long animal. Ross Chambliss has the story of the lake from the perspective of its biggest freshwater source.
The Bear River really provides a story that's all about the West and how it's evolved and how it's evolving. And all those critical issues regarding water seem to be nested in the Bear River.
That's Craig Denton, professor of documentary journalism at the University of Utah. Recently, I met him in his office on campus. For several years, he explored and photographed the entire Bear River watershed and the people connected to the river, which culminated in a book and an exhibit in 2007 titled Bear River, Last Chance to Change Course. Denton says he began his project thinking he would tell the story in the first person as the voice of the river. But in time, he says, he found this cumbersome. At the end of the day, he says, we can only speak from a human point of view.
Well, I'm a landscape documentarian or a landscape documentary photographer. And so one of the interests I have, and I think one of the skills I've developed, is telling the story of places and spaces that, because they don't have a voice, oftentimes can't be heard in the public discourse. So in all of my landscape documentaries, the Bear River included, and also the earlier West Desert work, I spent a lot of time in the field learning about the land, coming to understand it, its hydrology in the case of the Bear River, or the geomorphology of particular land forms. And so I do a lot of research ahead of time before I ever begin to start photographing. I can't photograph something unless I know what it is that I'm photographing and it has a purpose.
The Bear River's headwaters begin here, high in the Uinta Mountains in northeastern Utah. It meanders up through Wyoming and Idaho, crossing political borders and connecting with many communities along the way. It's one of the longest rivers in the West, meandering about 500 miles in length. Around Soda Point, Idaho, it makes a U-turn and heads south, where it eventually reaches the Great Salt Lake. Craig Denton says he became intimately aware of the river's stakeholders.
And inevitably, in this particular story, you have Native Americans. They've always been a presence on the Bear River since Anglo settlement in the 1800s. You see a variety of different roles taken by Anglos, farming, ranching, wildlife protection, water management, all those varieties of different human interests and preoccupations are all identified in the Bear River. So my job was basically to triangulate and to find those spokespeople in the for the various interest areas, identify them, and then begin a dialogue with each one of them.
And they all bring some different approach or interest to the river, right? Some of them gain pleasure from it. Some of it, it's a source of economic income. Some of it's just historical, cultural ties to the river.
Absolutely. All sorts of interests are represented. And one of the primary tensions and, to some degree, conflict between these particular stakeholders on the Bear River has to do with what you just said. Those who see it as an economic engine for them, whether or not they're ranchers or farmers or power generators, that's their primary interest. Those who don't have economic interest are ones who find the Bear River just a superb place to recreate, whether or not it's rafting, kayaking, fishing, canoeing. And that particular group of people, as in the West in general, more and more people are finding our natural resources, their primary use is recreation. And the economic imperative isn't quite as important as it used to be in terms of numbers of people, but obviously it's very important to the people who still rely upon the Bear as an economic resource.
For those who see water as critical to future economic growth, the Bear River is Utah's last untapped water source. In 1991, the state legislature directed the Division of Water Resources to begin plans to dam the Bear River in several places for storing and piping the water to growing northern Utah communities. But Craig Denton pictures our water needs differently.
The fact that we consume so much water per capita in the state of Utah, although on its face looks problematic because we're using more water than we should. But on the other hand, conservation is the best way to find new water. It's the least expensive, and also it's the most identifiable ways to create, in effect, new water. And the fact that we waste so much of our water then logically means we have more to save, more to conserve, so we have the potential to create more new water through conservation, again, because we use so much of it now.
So you also wrote that the Bear River Development Act blindly moves us ahead with a life of its own. It requires Utah water managers to devise ways to divert 220,000 acre-feet of Bear River water at the expense of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem. That was back in 2007. It's now 2015, and it seems like talk of developing the river is still moving ahead, even more so perhaps. And it's being pushed at the state level by our elected officials and state agencies. What can we all do to perhaps not be blind to this issue?
Well, one thing would serve us well is to have a bit more humility when it comes to our environment. That too often that we see human beings as the pinnacle of organisms in the hierarchy of importance on the ecology of the river. And if we realize that our human uses of water really don't take into account the needs of the entire ecosystem. And once we begin to think more broadly, have a different sense, an expanded sense of place, then I think that we can develop that notion of humility where we begin to see that our actions as human beings have a dramatic effect not only on other organisms, the fauna and the flora, the Bear River, but entire ecosystems. And we can't continue to act blindly without having a better sense of the place that we occupy in a larger nature, that until we do that, we're going to continue to make the same mistakes. And just as you said, the same challenges that were there in 2007 are the same challenges that are there here now in 2015, and they may be magnified because our population has grown, and so the need to create new water or conserve water is even greater now than it was 8 years ago.
Not long ago, I ventured out onto a lonely road where the Bear River meanders into the marshes of the Great Salt Lake.
Okay, standing Bear River Bird Migratory Bird Refuge, and it's the sound of bugs.
I didn't realize it at the time, but these swarming insects were in fact brine flies, millions, maybe billions of them.
The brine flies, when everybody comes here to see them, or, you know, is visiting the Great Salt Lake, and they're, like you say, overwhelmed with all of the brine flies flying around. Well, they don't bite, and they're actually not feeding at all during that time. They're actually just mating. Yeah, my name's John Left. I'm the program manager for the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program. And for the most part, we manage the brine shrimp fishery out on Great Salt Lake, but we also monitor bird migratory bird populations along the lake.
Left recently here at his office on the eastern shore of the lake.
I probably was as guilty as anybody when I came to work on this program. I didn't think a whole very highly of the Great Salt Lake. I thought it was salty. You couldn't catch a fish in there, so what good was it? You know, so it was interesting for me to see kind of an evolution of learning about it, understanding it, and really the big thing for me is watching real science and real scientists collect data and understand what's going on out there and how important that really was.
The state's Division of Wildlife Resources and its management of the brine shrimp industry has come a long way. It was actually the competing brine shrimp companies themselves who approached the state 20 years ago asking for more regulation. They worried that over-harvesting and poor management could collapse the resource. So the state hired Dr. Gary Belovsky, a former Utah State University biology professor, who designed a carefully calculated science-based formula to manage the resource that has since supported a multi-million dollar commercial brine shrimping industry. Meanwhile, Luff's job is to make sure enough brine shrimp cysts remain as food for the tens of millions of migratory birds stopping at the lake each year. Still, Luff says the low levels of the lake recently gives them little margin for error in managing the shrimp populations and the industry. He understands the Great Salt Lake oscillates through wet and dry cycles, but he says bird populations on the lake are stressed by the extreme low water.
So there's very little water habitat available there. So why the birds come here is for the food, and it's typically aquatic invertebrates or aquatic vegetation that they're going to be feeding on. Well, without the water, There are no aquatic vertebrates, invertebrates, or there's no aquatic vegetation. It's just not there for them.
Areas like the federally controlled Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge have impoundments to keep water levels high, so they are less impacted. But Luff says it's the less managed areas of the lakefront that are suffering. The low water has allowed Phragmites, an invasive and tall grassy weed, to move in, robbing even more water from the birds and aquatic creatures that depend on it. Even some of the protected nesting islands, such as Gunnison and Egg Island, are no longer islands.
My last flight over Gunnison, there's a land bridge that comes across to it. And it's a particular concern because it's a bird rookery. It's protected, owned by the state, and it's protected as a bird rookery because it's the only place that the American white pelicans are nesting. It's the third largest colony of American white pelicans. With that land bridge being there, you run the risk of having predators, and for the most part, we're probably talking about coyotes that would be able to access that island. And once they have access to the island, if it's during nesting season, pretty much that's it for the colony. And so they usually just abandon completely if they're disturbed. And that's why they're protected.
The vanishing islands, the shrinking shoreline, and the exposed lake bed, these are all symptoms of what will happen if, indeed, the Bear River is developed in the future. Again, the Bear River provides roughly 70% of the Great Salt Lake's inflow. The Utah Division of Water Resources says damming it will drop the lake's level by 6 inches to a foot, a conservative estimate, some think. Still, no one can say what this would do to the lake's ecological integrity. It's a subject that troubles Luft.
You know, like I mentioned before, there are a couple of areas, like with waterfowl management areas here, and then us managing the brine shrimp population, it's nice to have the ability to do some management. Well, if you take the water away, it lessens that ability. And I guess that's what makes, at least as a wildlife manager, me more nervous.
The interests tied to the lake are diverse. The Audubon, Friends of Great Salt Lake, the shrimpers, the mineral extractors, the state, and the federal agencies. At the end of the day, Luff says, they all want the same thing.
Which is a healthy lake, because our livelihoods or business somehow depends on it. And seeing the evolution with battling over some of these things and now kind of working hand in hand has been a little bit refreshing, and it gives me some hope because we're all trying and hoping for the best for the lake. It's just that we're growing here along the front, and whether or not we can sustain that without impacting the lake, I'm not sure.
Thanks to Ross Chambliss for spending hours hanging out at the Great Salt Lake over the past few weeks to bring us these stories. And special thanks to the Western Soundscape Archive at the University of Utah's Marriott Library for helping us keep it real. They shared their recordings with us from the actual places described in our show today. The Source is a production of Utah Public Radio with support from iUtah. I had production help this month from Ryan Cunningham. Thanks to Elaine Taylor for sharing her Salt and Sea story with the program, and thanks to all of you who shared your Spiral Jetty stories with me. There will be more opportunities to contribute to the program for future episodes. Make sure you're following Utah Public Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Use the hashtag UPRSource to catch our attention. I'm on Twitter too, @YearOfJen. The next episode of The Source will be Friday, April 24th at 9 a.m., right here wherever you're listening to Utah Public Radio. Recordings, photos, and other digital paraphernalia related to today's show are up at upr.org. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thanks for listening.